You're listening to the Marketing Advisor Radio Show.
The audience cares.
We've got a guest, as usual, and this guest you've heard from before. His name is Scott Grant. Standfast Asset Management is the name of the company that Scott represents. And as you may or may not remember, last time we had him on, he is a local historian. Yeah, we talked last time about World War II.
What was funny about, just to give people my little history lesson of this show.
Yeah.
So last time we had Scott on, you know, we brought him in to talk about asset management. And, you know, we're so interested in history around here, we really stopped. Let's stop with the finances for a second. Well, tell me about this World War II ship, you know,
right.
The German ship off the Jacksonville coast. And so we forced him to talk about that for, I think, like three segments. But I think he enjoyed his stay, and he's back, so that's good.
I love talking the history and just talking about the submarine attack. On Pearl Harbor Day, I gave the speech about the submarine attack for the 60th time this year.
Wow.
And I keep running into people, and I'll say, oh, I give this speech, and they'll go, oh, I've heard it. And not just once often, but they'll say, oh, I've heard you twice.
Oh, in fact, my wife, you gave a speech to a group of mothers that my wife belongs to. And she came home and said, I heard this fascinating story about the submarines in World War II.
Oh, Trey, you should have just started acting like... You know what? You knew the story, and just like, oh, you mean that thing where this happened and this happened?
Everybody knows that.
And that commander lived for so long, and he made this trip to Jacksonville. I read a book about that.
Yeah.
You would have sounded so smart.
Right. No, she knows better than
that's
that.
That's true.
We've been married.
But Scott did actually come talk to my Rotary Club as well, and it was one of the most fascinating speeches I've seen in the entire year. So it was
great. That's really nice. Thank you very, very much.
I mean, I don't mean that just from my perspective.
Well, and Craig was there, too.
Feedback from the rest of the group. I got that. Hey, Rusty, great guest. You know, this kind of thing.
Hey, mind you, I was never invited back. So I don't know what that says about me.
Well, there was too much food, Trey. We noticed you went back three times for, you know, food. And we have to pay for all that. So.
Right, right. We've also got Jennifer Price.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I guess based off of our discussion of local history in the World War II era, I'd like to bring it home a little bit and talk about history. You've got some knowledge about our stations that I don't have, so I'm hoping you could share with me and our audience here a little bit about the history of our stations.
Yeah, mostly about WAPE, which is I think the original station. You guys call it the
Big Ape.
The Big Ape. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
The Big Ape was founded in '58. It was a kind of a combination rock and roll and country and pop station initially. But in 1963, they increased the transmitter size to 50,000 watts. And that made it the largest radio station in this area. And it could be heard as far away as Charleston, South Carolina, Cape Canaveral. And in fact, it was advertised that way on the roadside. People traveling up and down Route 17, which was the route that you would use to get to Florida before 95, would see billboards, and the billboards would have a Big Ape on it and the 690 AM dial, and it would say 500 miles of music.
Which I can see as a benefit. If you're driving that kind of distance, you'd probably want to find a station that is going to play quality music that you like and not have to fiddle around and go from station to station through every town. I can see that as a benefit. I do have a question, though. As an advertiser, if you're a local business in Jacksonville and you're advertising 500 miles away for, I don't know, a dental practice, people aren't going to travel that kind of distance.
Well, I'll answer in one way. I'll say that I don't think it was 500 miles in one direction. I think it was 250 in one direction, 250 the other direction. So, but still, your point is well taken, Greg. Yeah, 250 is still quite a distance. But just to help people put that in perspective a little bit, if you are listening on the AM signal right now, which is AM 690, that's 50,000 watts still to this day. And that was the original ape signal. I think Scott's going to tell us a little bit more about that. But if you're listening on the 104.5 signal, the FM signal, it's a 100,000 watt station, which is the highest allowed by law. And that's really, I mean, for an AM station, that's powerful. And I think Scott can talk about this a little bit, but I know that just so people know, we have to turn that signal down at night because when it's nighttime, the signal travels farther, and you can hear us in all kinds of weird places.
I've heard as far away as Chicago.
I've heard like people out on you know, deep sea fishing boats and commercial boats get heard all over the ocean.
Yeah, because it bounces off the top of the water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, any place near the water would travel further. And back in 63, they did have to turn down the signal at night. And when they turned it down at night, initially it did not travel nearly as far. But that 50,000 watts, one of the advertising pieces that you guys or WAPE used back in those days was as strong as any station in the nation. Yeah. So there was nobody at that point with a bigger tower than 50,000 watts.
Well, it is the heritage radio station in Jacksonville. I mean, it really is. And when we have people come in and do tours and things like that of our studio, that's the first kind of thing we mention. Like, we'll go and show them all the old memorabilia of the Ape. Right. There is the big Ape, like the actual Ape is sitting in the lobby, the one that used to be on the Orange Park sign. We recovered that a couple of years ago. I don't know the full story about how we got it back, but I do know we had to pay a little bit for it. But you know, that one where the eyes light red, and I mean, in fact, I'll take a picture of it and I'll put it on our Marketing Advisors Facebook page.
That's a great idea.
If somebody wants to go look at it.
Well, the last time I was here, the three of us got our picture taken in front of it, and it's periodically shows up as on my Facebook page. The three of us standing in front of the Ape.
I want to apologize in advance for Rusty's demeanor in those pictures. To any audience members that might go to your Facebook page?
Being bald is not a demeanor, Treg. It's just, it's natural. I can't help it.
Right.
Anyway, Scott, tell us some more interesting.
Well, what's really interesting about this story and why it's important is that this is the largest radio station in this area. And in 1964, the Beatles come to the United States for the second time. And because of this radio station, the Beatles play essentially the only concert that they ever played in the state of Florida. And they play it on September 11th, 1964 at the Gator Bowl. Mm-hmm. And WAPE was the sponsor.
The sponsor.
The only sponsor.
Wow.
If you look at the tickets, like, say, out of Shea or out of, I forget the name of the stadium in Washington, but some of the other stadium shows, and there are multiple sponsors on the ticket. But the only sponsor of this show was WAPE.
And I've seen these tickets, Trey. Yeah. I've seen, they used to hang here in our office. I think somebody must have left our company and taken them with them. I didn't know, realize. I think it really was their personal property, and they had come and hung it on the wall. But I've seen that, and I know exactly what you mean. It looks kind of generic, not like today's tickets where you see these cool logos and flashy graphics. It was just kind of like WAPE in like a courier font or something like that. But you're right. I have seen them before.
There's a big reason why you guys were the only sponsor of this particular concert.
Do tell.
Well, I mean, it had a lot to do with the morals of the time. I mean, people in Jacksonville, the older people in particular, were not all that happy that the Beatles were coming here. You know, they didn't really fit in with sort of that Southern lifestyle. Additionally, there's the big fight, and kind of jumping ahead here, but let's get to the meat. The big fight about the Beatles coming here was that the Gator Bowl was segregated. Huh. And by law, by contract with the city, and the city had no interest in having an integrated show in the Gator Bowl. Mm-hmm. The Beatles had no interest in performing in front of a segregated audience. John Lennon said he would sooner give up his appearance money. And ultimately, the Beatles issue a press statement that said if Negroes and whites are not allowed to sit together, we will not come to the show. So when we were together last time, which was not on the radio, I was telling you guys, I mean, WAPE changed Jacksonville. The very first segregated event in Gator Bowl history is this show that gets put on by WAPE and was brought here by the station manager, a guy named Jim Atkins.
That's an incredible piece of history. And I do want to continue this story. We're running up on a break, though, so let's take a quick commercial timeout. You're listening to the Marketing Advisor Radio Show, subbing today for a history lesson in Jacksonville history. Be right back.
News 104.5 and AM 690 WOKV.
Good evening, Jacksonville. Thank you for joining us for the second wonderful segment of the Marketing Advisors on News 104.5 WOKV. I'm Rusty Winter. I've got Treg Kazik, as always, in studio with me, running things, running the board, and making sure everything goes all right. We've also got Scott Grant and Jennifer Price from Standfast Asset Management. And if you were listening in the first segment, I'll just remind you that when we had Scott on last time, we were planning on talking about asset management and a little bit of history, because he is a historian and really digs deep into subjects. And we had him on last time. He started talking about that situation where we had a submarine, a German sub, sink a merchant ship off the Jacksonville coast. And I kind of stuck there. You know, I was like, we're not getting out of that. We're going to talk about this whole thing, and we'll get to asset management later. And we're kind of going to do the same thing today. But Scott's got a new thing that's been on his mind, and it's so near and dear to us because it involves the history of one of our stations in our group, which is the Big Ape, which is the heritage radio station in our city. And so he's kind of talking about the history there. We got into the Beatles a little bit. And one of my questions was, Scott, you mentioned that it was really the only, you said they mentioned, or the Beatles played twice in Florida in their lifetime, one being the Gator Bowl in 1964. Why did they choose our fine city in 1964 as opposed to, you know, one of the bigger ones?
Well, I mean, the biggest reason is because of WAPE, because you had this big signal. You could advertise the show. As far away as Charleston, mm-hmm. Cape Canaveral, inland over to Tampa, people traveled from all over Florida to see this thing, and really from all over the country, but particularly from all over Florida. And the station manager at that time was a guy named Jim Atkins, and Jim Atkins puts the show together. It's his baby, and he gets the Beatles to come here. They play 32 concert dates in 33 days. Now, sometimes they play two in a single day, so it's not like they were playing every single day but one. But they play a lot of concerts, and they wanted big stadiums, and the Gator Bowl was a big stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And so the promoters pitched the Beatles, and then they, in turn, Atkins and WAPE, rented the Gator Bowl. And that's where you come into this civil rights question, because this Gator Bowl was owned by the city. And the city had an ordinance, and the ordinance said there could not be an integrated event at the Gator Bowl.
What about, you know, when you said 1964, I remember that as being Hurricane Dora month, right? Or Hurricane Dora year,
yeah.
Which was obviously the biggest to hit Jacksonville. How did that affect the concert?
You know, that's interesting. I like that story, too. It affected a lot, first off. The hurricane hits at Volano. The eye of the hurricane crosses Volano just after midnight on September 10th, 1964. This concert is September 11th. The hurricane does a lot of damage. In fact, one of the things that in my folio article that I wrote about 1964, talk about the water being hip deep in the what they used to call the slave market, the old slave market in St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. We now call it Plaza de la Constitución. But you know that pavilion there?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I know
hip
it well.
Deep.
Yeah.
The water was running hip deep through there after after Dora hit. The very next morning, LBJ comes to Jacksonville, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president at that time, to survey the damage. And his motorcade races across the Fuller Warren, like 80, 90 miles an hour to the beach. And he walks around on top of some of the broken structures, and he has his picture taken, and he travels back to Eimsen Airfield, flies back to Washington. A couple hours later, the Beatles land at 5:30 on September 11th to perform that night at 7:30, 2 hours later. They had planned to come a couple days earlier. Their plane had been diverted to Key West because of the hurricane. The winds were still buffeting pretty strongly at the time, so strongly that they needed to nail Ringo's drum set to the stage to keep it from blowing over during the performance.
Wow. That's cool.
So it was a pretty busy time for Jacksonville those couple of days.
Absolutely.
A lot of bigwig visitors, LBJ.
Yeah, you think about it. I mean, the president, the Beatles, the biggest hurricane ever to hit this area. Those three pretty big events, and they take place in 36 hours.
Scott, I know you have more to talk about in terms of 1964 and the story, but I'm just curious about your research techniques. You know, I was just thinking about how do you how do you find this information? How do you go about really drilling in? Because I know when you do a search like this, when you start looking at a subject as broad as 1964 Jacksonville, there's got to be a lot to filter through. And so I'm just curious a little bit about your process.
One of the things I really like is firsthand sources. So I go down to libraries, in this case, the Jacksonville Public Library downtown right off of Hemming Park, and you go through the old newspapers. You just go through them and you print out stuff that's interesting.
Is that a special room that you have to sign in and do all that kind of stuff?
Good.
Oh, it's definitely museum quality. Everybody needs to see that.
Well, I've seen it on the outside, and I went up and talked to the lady at the little security thing before and said, it wasn't like they would stop me from going in. I would just have to sign a few things and get a little permission, but
They've got like 200 maps, original maps, all mounted and framed and up on the walls. It's definitely something to see.
I don't think a lot of people even realize that exists, that you can go into our main library and actually go and look at some original documents of our history.
And there are archives going back even further, and I'm sure there are documents in there where they'd make you put on the gloves and use the spatula to turn the pages. The newspapers are still all on microfiche, and they're deteriorating rapidly. The microfiche is not lasting, and there's some historical societies in the United States that are digitizing those. And I don't know of any plans to do it in Jacksonville, but they should, because ultimately we're going to lose all that stuff.
So when you go into that room and you read the newspaper, I'm assuming you find some names. Do you look some of those folks up, see if they're still living?
Occasionally, yeah. Occasionally. It depends. Sometimes I do look them up, and I attempt to find them, and I run into a dead end. My favorite one of these, I gave my speech in St. Augustine to the Rotary Club that meets at Casa Monica. And at the end, the question time, a man stood up and began to tell his story. And as soon as he began to tell his story, I said, he's telling Eddie Musalem's story. I've read this a bunch of times in a bunch of different sources, but I thought he was dead. And the reason I thought he was dead is that I had actually seen his grave. But when I go back later, I realize that, yes, his grave is there, but the final date's not there. He put it in for his wife. His wife had passed away.
Okay.
And it kind of freaked me out at the time, because I was like, who's this guy telling this story? So sometimes you find people and sometimes you don't. One of the things that happens with the submarine story is a lot of the people started to find me now. They come looking for me and they say my dad or my mom was there at the time, and he or she wants to tell you their story.
That's pretty cool. And I sure hope that happens after this broadcast. You know, folks familiar with the Beatles coming to town reach out to you and say, this was my experience, you know, and you learn a little bit more.
I would love to hear from people who were there. And I have heard from people who were there at the show. The most common thing that they say is that between the wind and the screaming of the fans, that you could barely hear any of the music.
Oh, geez. Well, you're listening to the Marketing Advisor Radio Show. Although, if you've been listening for the past couple of segments, you'd think it's the Marketing History Show.
We might should do that once a month.
We probably should. It wouldn't be a bad segment. I'd tell you what. Thanks for listening. We'll be back after these messages.
Weekday mornings 5 till 9 a.m. Jacksonville's only all-news morning show, with weather and traffic every 6 minutes. Jacksonville's Morning News with Rich Jones. Weekday mornings on News 104.5 WOKV.
Welcome back to the Marketing Advisors on Treg's looking at me like I'm weird.
No. News 104.5 WOKV.
Oh, I forgot. Thanks, Treg.
Yes.
You are back on the Marketing Advisors. Treg's look was fine. He was wincing in pain at something, maybe hernia or something like that. But I
think I got arthritis in my foot. Anyway.
Sorry to hear that, Treg. Foot massage later, but it won't be for me. Anyway, welcome back to the Marketing Advisors. We're having a fun discussion again. We've got Scott Grant back on. You know, he's with Standfast Asset Management, and we never let him talk about asset management, which is kind of funny because he's also a historian, and he's got all these interesting stories. And the last time he was on, he talked to us about the merchant ship that got shot by a German U-boat back during World War II. And now he's got kind of a we're not going that far back in history, but we are going back a ways, and we're going back to think about 1964 and the British invasion of, you think, the United States, British invasion of Jacksonville.
Right.
And what I mean is the Beatles, of course. And Scott, I had asked you before the last break to tell us a little bit about how you do your research, and you were telling us about how you find these original sources, and you'll go back to, you know, how press clippings and things like that. So my question now is, tell us about how the press covered that event back then.
Well, generally, I think the older people in the Jacksonville area were not too excited that the Beatles were coming. The younger people were. But the Beatles were still new. They were different. They had long hair. They were largely viewed as interlopers. They made themselves less popular with that segment of the population by insisting that this concert be integrated, which was a big deal back in 1964. Now you look at here and you think, but it was a big deal. The Times Union, actually the opening band, one of the opening bands was the Exciters. And the Exciters' most popular hit is a song called Tell Him. If you heard it, you'd go, oh, yeah.
No. That's Trey's wedding song, I think.
I'm going to have to YouTube that.
But the Exciters were an African-American band. And in the concert, in the write up the following day in the Times Union, they're not even mentioned.
Okay. I see where this is going.
Yeah. But in general, they talked about the Beatles. The Times Union was upset that they were here. They write a number of editorials. They refer to them as a passing fad.
Kind of like the internet, huh?
In pockets, right?
it's funny to think of them as a passing fad now. Right. But yeah, that there had been a ton of research into why the Beatles were popular, all of which came down to one thought: they were a passing fad.
Hmm.
And they write in there that says they hope that the kids of today will get over this. But that the really frightening thought...
Sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Let me read this wonderful thought. The frightening thought is that cultural standards will continue so to decline that they will react like today's elders to the noises to which their children will be listening.
Oh, boy.
So the more things basically change, the more things stay the same.
Right? Nirvana and, you know, Nine Inch Nails. I mean, they were... you could remember people from that era... When the grunge rock hits, saying, it's noise, it's noise, it's just noise. Back in my day, we listened to the Beatles.
They right.
it's so innocent. True, though. It really is. And I kind of, my daughter wants to change her hair color to blue this summer. She wants to totally dye her hair blue.
Okay.
And I just said, fine, if you want to do that. What I started getting visions of are what I used to do when I was that age. And if that's the worst she wants to do, then by all means, I'll even pay to... let you get it done.
Right on.
So what was kind of like the aftermath of all this? Take us to – so the concert was September 11th. Take us the rest of the year. I mean, what's kind of like the aftermath, the changes or anything like that?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question and a very interesting question. 1964 is an election year. LBJ's running against what's the guy's name from Arizona?
Sorry. Not Adelaide. No. What was that?
In any event, he ends up killing the guy, but he comes back to Jacksonville in October for a speech. But the other event that year, and there are a lot of events in 1964 in Jacksonville, but the other major event that year is that in October of 1964, Bob Hayes wins 2 gold medals in the Tokyo Olympics. Bob Hayes is from Jacksonville.
That's right.
World's fastest man. He goes to Florida A&M. And he goes to Tokyo in October. And I don't know why the Summer Olympics were in October that year. Probably had something to do with Tokyo weather. And in October, he wins 2 gold medals. And the day that he wins the 100, Martin Luther King Jr. is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, largely for things he does in St. Augustine, Florida, in June of 1964.
June. Okay, so it was a few months prior to the Beatles coming.
Right.
I just looked at it as Barry Goldwater.
Oh, thank you, Barry Goldwater.
I was going to say Goldwater.
Yeah, and Curtis LeMay was his running mate. I can't believe I forgot Barry Goldwater. But he gets beaten badly. Goldwater gets killed. LBJ wins. In terms of the Beatles, this is pretty much the end of their tour. They go back to England after that. And they don't come to the United States ever again, right? That's it.
I'm guess curious, so. In any of your research, did you find where policies in Jacksonville from the city had changed at all as a result of allowing this one integrated event?
Well, yeah, I think they did. I mean, clearly, you know, once you start to go towards integration, you can't go back.
Right.
The events in St. Augustine that I was referring to earlier led in large part to the passage of the Civil Rights Act in early July of 1964, which made it illegal in any part of the United States to deny for a restaurant or a hotel to deny service to anyone, not just African Americans, but Asians and Hispanics and anybody else who would have prior to that been turned away. But it doesn't happen immediately. Right. You know, there's a lot of pushback. You know, one of the images that's burned in my mind is in August, the Klan pickets, some of the hotels and restaurants in St. Augustine, and they march up and down with signs that say, whites and coloreds mix here. You know, don't eat at this restaurant. And so there was some back and forth, and the courts were busy with this stuff. I mean, you know, both sides were trying to make their point to keep things segregated.
What about violence? Was there a lot of any kind of violence?
There was tons of violence in 1964. Yeah,
sure.
The very first child to integrate the schools in Jacksonville had their home was firebombed.
Oh, gee.
The story that I kind of like is out of St. Augustine, and the parents of one of the first black children to go to an elementary school in St. Augustine went to a PTA meeting. And when they left the PTA meeting to go home, they came out and their car was on fire.
It's amazing. It's frightening to think that kind of stuff actually happened. You know, I wasn't alive.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can...
No, it is, and it is frightening.
Been happening for thousands of years.
And actually, one of my fears, and, you know, I wrote this article for Folio, but one of my fears is that, you know, I tell these stories and people say, oh, these people were awful back in 1964. And, you know, from our current way of looking at things, they were. But at the time, that was just the normal. I'm not trying to defend them either.
No.
But I don't want to just say, you know, people in Jacksonville or St. Augustine, you know, were horrible people in 1964. There were some horrible people.
Sure. As evidenced by car bombings and house bombings.
Right. Yeah. And shootings. You know, there were a number of shootings. There was a woman walking along the road. She was shot by three men in a car. Initially, some people were charged, and then later on, the charges were dropped, and somebody else was charged. But she was shot. It was an older African-American woman was just shot for walking down the road.
Well, we promise you are listening to the Marketing Advisors right now, but we love to have Scott come in and talk about history of our city. I mean, this is fantastic, and we'll have him on again for the next time he comes up with whatever he wants to dig into. It'll be something interesting, I guarantee you that. We have been talking to Scott about 1964 in Jacksonville and the British invasion and really what happened all around that. You know, Hurricane Dora was that year, and it's been really, really fascinating. Scott is going to stick around for our last segment. But we're sort of going to be done with the history part of our show, and we're going to talk
more. What is end of year? We should probably talk a couple things financial.
I think so.
That seems appropriate.
That is very appropriate, and that's Scott's other side of his expertise, so we will get there. You've been listening to the Marketing Advisors. Do not tune out because the next segment is going to be fantastic. Be right back.
News 104.5 and AM 690 WOKV.
Good evening, folks. Welcome back. You are listening to the Marketing Advisor Radio Show. My name is Treg Kazik. I'm here with Rusty Winter, our good friends from Standfast Asset Management, Scott Grant and Jennifer Price. And we have been talking all things, well, not all things, but some history about Jacksonville, Florida, and specifically 1964 and the Beatles and their effect and things that happened that year. But Scott and Jennifer are in the asset management business. It is the end of the year. It seems appropriate we should discuss one or two things about that. But before we dive into that, I know over the break we were looking up the Dow in 64 versus today. So could you share with our listeners some of that data?
In 1964, the Dow was around 750, and today it's 24,500. But the increase in value that an investor would have received over that period would have been more, because every year there would have been dividends from the stocks, and that would have added up to a substantially larger amount of money than just increasing, say, from 750 to 24,500.
Right.
It would have been a big number.
That's incredible. So being the end of the year, looking at our portfolios, what 2018 is going to have in store for us, what are some of the things that we should take a look at and maybe revisit as far as our portfolios go?
Well, you know, New Year's is always a good time to look at your life, your investments, your insurance, whatever you're looking at, because it's a new year, and that's the way we sort of think. It's new promises, new beginnings. So first off, before the end of the year, you want to look at your portfolio, particularly if you have a stock portfolio or any kind of investment portfolio. And if you have losses, you probably want to take them, and you probably particularly want to take them this year, because it's likely that they will be less valuable to you next year if the current tax law passes, which everyone expects that it will.
Got it. So if you take a hit take it now. Before,
right, and save money on your taxes. Yep. And people often don't know this, but if you have a loss, and say that you were foolish enough to buy GE 3 or 4 years ago.
I'm right here, Scott.
Right.
He's just talking about the foolish part. He doesn't know GE.
The GE part. But you can take the loss. You can write that off on your income taxes. You'll save some money doing that. How much depends on how long you've held the GE and what your tax bracket is, but you would save some money. But beyond that, it's a good time to look at the investments. And if somebody, let's say, owns an annuity, a universal life policy, or any kind of insurance that was sold to them as a substitute for an investment, it's a good time, maybe a good time in January, to sit down with somebody like us and say, you know, is this the right kind of investment for me?
Okay. You know, over the break, we were talking about Bitcoin. I don't know all that much about it, but I hear that phrase all the time. I don't understand it. And I was wondering if you could shed some light on that for me.
Sure. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency. There are a lot of them now. The Bitcoin is the original cryptocurrency. It's essentially a online currency that trades like any other currency versus the dollar, and versus, you know, the yen and the yuan and all the rest. But it's very mysterious. And for that reason, a lot of people, including myself, have always had sort of a jaundiced eye about Bitcoins. But I do want to tell you the Bitcoin story, and it's another Jacksonville story, so it's a good one.
All right.
In 2010... a guy named Laszlo, who was a software engineer, had accumulated 10,000 bitcoins. And he went on the internet and he bought 2 pepperoni pizzas for 10,000 bitcoins. And he bought them. It was actually a guy in England ordered 2 pizzas from Papa John's and had them delivered to Laszlo in exchange for these 10,000 bitcoins, which were worth $41 mm-hmm. at the time, those 10,000 coins. The pizza was $24. Laszlo got his 2 pizzas. The guy in England made a profit of $17. But those 10, when I wrote the article for Newsline on November 10th of this year, those 10,000 bitcoins were now worth $70 million, which is a very expensive pizza.
Now, help me understand how those bitcoin are worth $70 million. There's nothing.
Well, I can tell you everything is worth what somebody will pay for it, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's that. And I know that the dollar is no longer backed up by bullion or gold or any precious metal or anything, which befuddles me too. But
we go off the gold standard in the Nixon administration, I think in 74. And when we go off, it's interesting. The price of gold is $40 an ounce, and it has been set at $40 an ounce, or give or take 40, since the Bretton Woods conference during the FDR administration. And as soon as we deregulate the price of gold and go off the gold standard, the price of gold goes through the roof.
But back to the Bitcoin. So 70 million, these 10,000, is there any way to explain how it became so valuable? Like, what is it that...
I think it's one of those phenomenon where people just think they're going to make money and they just keep throwing money in. It's a bubble. I mean, when I write the article, I'm arguing that it's a bubble. And part of what I say is, you know, something that was worth a meal, and not even a really expensive meal 7 years ago, is now worth the price of a yacht. There's something wrong. Now, I do want to point out that since I wrote that article, the price of those 70 million in bitcoins was up to 170 million 2 days ago.
Oh, my goodness. That's just phenomenal to me.
Well, it's going to burst.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to.
No doubt about it. But I think there's just people like thinking, well, hopefully it's not today and I'm going to grab some profit from it.
And that's what's called the greater fool theory. And the greater fool theory works like this. You say, I'm a fool to be buying bitcoins at $7,000, but I'll find a greater fool, a bigger fool than me, to buy it from me at $17,000, which is what it's done in the last month. I think it's going to crash at some point, and possibly dangerously for the U.S. and for the world economy.
So you think there's enough people invested in this pyramid to, it, when it bursts, the bubble bursts, that it's going to have a detrimental effect on our economy?
I'm very nervous about that, actually. They just started trading futures on bitcoins in Chicago, and that's one of the signs, like signs of the apocalypse. And I'm nervous that when this thing bursts, it's going to cause some damage.
Well, I know there's a couple of forces working against it too. I mean, you can think about world governments hate this stuff. They want to be in charge of their own currencies,
sure.
And so I know there's got to be some folks up in you know, higher up that don't like what's happening and might do something. I have no idea what that would look like, but might do something to try to nix this whole thing. And then another thing I read about was it's almost impossible to buy things with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is like, okay, I can sell Bitcoin to other people that want Bitcoin, but I can't go buy something with it. It's
no
very,
goods and services.
Yeah, it's not like you can just pop on any shopping website and start spending Bitcoin.
It's
so
basically a forex.
It's very, very limited in terms of how you can spend it.
And, you know, the argument, one of the arguments in favor is that you can use these coins on the dark web. You know, criminals can use them.
Yeah.
And that's why they keep
finding that.
Well, I mean, as a libertarian, I love the concept. I love the concept of anything that goes around the government, you know, being the printing money and Federal Reserve, anything that can get around that, I'm a big fan of personally. I just know that I'm in the small minority. You know what I mean? And so I know there's probably more people not like me that would want to put the kibosh on this.
Understood. Well, you've given us a lot to digest, and certainly go out and do your own research. But thank you both for coming into studio today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
It was great. It's always great to be here with you guys.
Thanks for teaching us a little bit about Jacksonville history, the Beatles, 1964, Bitcoin, and what to look for and monitor in our portfolios for the upcoming year. Sure to appreciate it. You've been listening to the Marketing Advisor Radio Show. We'll speak with you next week.